slums stretching everywhere, swamps in your kitchen, grease getting in your hair, places are for bitching.
Everything here is the best thing ever. Everything here is the best thing ever. Everything here is the best thing ever. Everything here is the best thing ever.
Okay, so I am here with Justin Taylor, who is the author of Everything Here is the Best Thing Ever. Justin, how are you doing?
I'm doing real good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. That's great. I wanted to start off with an observation in your stories that I noted. Many of your stories don't actually name the protagonist until well into the narrative. In Tennessee, you don't even name check the main character at all. There's a suggestion he could be David or one of the anarchists, David being the bookish character
right. In
the two anarchist stories with Snapcase. I'm curious why there's this reluctance to name the characters right off the bat, and I'm wondering if you feel that you need to have a handle on your protagonist before you, in fact, offer their identity. Maybe we can talk about this interesting little creative scenario you have frequently in these stories.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. There's no one single good reason. I mean, you know, at the most basic level, some of it is technical. A guy is speaking in his own voice. He's describing what he sees. Obviously, he already knows his own name, and so it's not going to be, of a special importance to him to point that out. He's also not going to tell you what color his own eyes are, right? I mean, it's the kind of information that's either going to have to come from somebody else. You know, somebody's addressing him, which is, I think, typically what happens. In the stories, and there's this weird kind of anxiety about naming that sort of connects to the shiftlessness of some of these characters, and some of the sort of larger anxieties or just shapelessness of their lives that they almost don't see themselves as people who have names or maybe they would almost rather not be named, to assert one's own name. To really own one's name, to be that person. It sounds silly. I mean, everybody has a name, but there really is. There's an assertion. The most basic assertion of ego. I am Justin. And then that's something that a lot of these people are not especially interested in saying. Right? They're not interested in. They either can't figure out how to do it, or they're not interested in the host of responsibilities that might be part and parcel of making that assertion. And so they do, they very often are only named by others.
Yeah.
When a situation has gotten to the point where someone is addressing them. And very typically, right, in when you're in situations with your intimates, whether they're friends, family, lover, whoever, very often, names don't get used, right? Because it's just the two of you speaking, and why would you? There's no confusion about who's being addressed, and there is this weird formality in the act of pronouncing the name, right? I mean, it's typically you're at some sort of impasse. Someone is trying to communicate, a real dissatisfaction or concern or whatever, and so these people tend to be named in the texts, at those moments. And that's the highfalutin answer. The sort of, again, the more practical answer is, there's a lot of first-person narrators in this collection, and I wanted to make clear that they're not all the same person. It's not a novel in stories, and so by giving each person a name at some point, but keeping it small and keeping them different, I felt like I was able to preserve, some of the formal stuff that I was going for, the idea of the crisis of naming, but also communicate that it is not, in fact, the same I. People are in different places. They're different characters. They're different ages, different regions, this and that.
Yeah. Well, from a strictly creative standpoint, I'm wondering if when the name announces that you feel that the character has been confirmed in some sense in your head, or do you have a pretty good idea of who the character is from the get-go before you even revealed the name to the reader?
No, I mean, the characters reveal themselves, over the course of what they do.
Yeah.
And over the course of the actions of the stories and that kind of stuff. The names very often come later. I'm not that concerned with what the names of any of the characters really are. I don't think any of and most of the names tend to be short, not quite generic, but certainly common. And it's not a bid for the everyman position or whatever. I mean, that's not really a concern. But yeah, anybody's name could be almost anybody else's name. Really, and that's That's not unintentional.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah. Well, there's also the risk, because in Weekend Away, I actually believed at one point, and I wasn't the only one because my girlfriend believed this too, the protagonist was actually a gay man until you revealed the line that she's essentially, I'm a wronged, lonely woman.
Right.
So I'm curious if there may in fact be a risk in the lack of specificity, and to what degree were you aware of that risk?
Yeah, there's absolutely a risk. You know, that story is the only story in the book that has a female protagonist, female narrator, in any case. She's speaking in her own voice. And there needed to be some way to communicate that, and especially since the story appears fairly late in the collection. If you're reading it sequentially, by this point, you've met, a variety of different men of various ages and stations, engaged in a variety of all manner and form of relationships. So a reader would be forgiven, more than understandable, thinking at first that this is a man. Although I tried to go pretty early on, the character's name is Rose, and I tried to get out there as fast as possible. And it's certainly not outside the realm of possibility that a gay man might have the name or choose to take on the name Rose. But I wanted to try and get it across without, when you anytime you have a first-person narrator, the reader's instant temptation is to identify that narrator with the author and the gender of the author. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, that is the default position until you communicate something otherwise. And so unless you're really willing to take it to that level where, as a male author, you're a female narrator, the story begins in the shower and, she's washing her large, beautiful breasts, and then this communicates to the reader that, like, this is, right? I mean, that classic, like, sort of undergraduate,
but
men
have breasts too, I mean, yeah. I don't know. Maybe it was just me.
You know what I mean, yeah. Right? I mean, you can sort of go for that sort of classic, bright neon sign, like, hey, this is what I'm doing, which I wasn't willing to do. And so I just kind of hoped, so I threw the name out there and then just sort of hoped to build it, throughout the story. But yeah, but what you really asked me was, is it a risk? Yeah, it was a risk.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, but it's not a collection of interconnected stories. I mean, that's the thing. It was, the stories are written for their own reasons, each apart from each other.
Yeah.
And so when you draw them all together in these kind of connections and sort of rhyming themes and ideas are drawn out, by critics or just by yourself from rereading it so much and ordering the thing, you start to notice this stuff. But what can you really do? I mean, I suppose I could have dropped the story from the collection, but I didn't want to. I really like that story.
To go back to this bright neon sign that you mentioned, I'm wondering if there's a concern on your part when you're writing fiction that you may in fact be too specific, that you're essentially giving the game away to some degree. I noticed that there were a good deal of similes throughout this, very truncated similes. You didn't want to exactly extend the sentences like that. So I'm wondering if you have a sort of a love-hate relationship about specificity. I'll go into specific things you do, in fact, actually bring up in the story
later.
Yeah,
please. Okay.
Yeah, for example, hair, which I'll talk about. I found the specificity of the hair throughout many of these stories to be quite funny and quite interesting. But I'm wondering why you aren't so specific about other details, like gesture sometimes, I'm wondering if you fear perhaps giving the game away to some degree.
I'm not really sure what you mean by giving the game away.
Giving the game away through like a hyper specific detail essentially like revealed your hand to the reader.
No, I wouldn't really say that's a concern. I mean, I think that my writing practice tends to err on the side, I think, of minimalism, or at least that's the goal anyway. I tend to write larger drafts and then edit them down. And I typically, if I'm on the fence about something, my inclination is to leave it on the cutting room floor rather than put it in. I would rather see if something works without it than see if something works with it. And so that may have something to do with it. But it also may just have something to do with, again, a lot of these characters and a lot of these stories either focus on or are actually narrated by people to whom certain things register, very largely and resonate very strongly, and certain things just don't register that strongly at all. A lot of these, and that's just the characters. So maybe some of the things that you're talking about are unspecified or, sort of vague on the details. It's just because those are things that don't mean that much to these people. They don't notice them, or they don't feel that they're worthy of comment, or you know, or this and that.
That's a fair answer. The line that concludes "Jewels flashing in the night of time," mm-hmm. that was what you wanted, right? It could mm-hmm. almost be a note to the reader, and it also recalled Amber at the window in Hurricane Season, where the reader is momentarily put into the place of Patrick with that second-person voice. I'm wondering, this interest in almost addressing the reader's presence, were these early stories that, is this something you've quelled, or how much are you interested in addressing the reader along these lines?
Addressing the reader directly in a kind of, you know,
yeah.
broken
or even obliquely
wall,
like
postmark.
That, yeah.
You know, not especially. I mean, it's certainly more in Amber. I mean, you know, Amber's a very short piece, and it opens the book, and you know, I wanted it to. It was almost more like an invocation than it, you know, than anything else, I think. And that was certainly why I wanted to put it there. And you know, and it takes that hard turn. At the beginning of that story. But the turn is actually away from addressing the reader, right? I mean, the story opens on Amber doing something, and then it moves into this second person. And so the reader feels that they're being addressed directly.
Yeah.
And then what's revealed on that second page, when the reader is given a name, is that in fact, it's not a second person story. It is not you, the reader, being addressed. You know, a guy is speaking to another guy. And he's not trying, you know, he's not trying to put you, the reader, in his shoes, right? I mean, at first that's what you think, but then it kind of kicks you back out, and it's like, no, this is actually a story about, you know, the guy who's speaking at first thinks he's telling a story about this woman, but then he slowly reveals, or even comes to realize, that in fact what he's really interested in is the relationship between these two men, and how, you know, and how this sort of, and how their individual relationships with this one woman, who at this point neither of them are, you know, are really involved with, you know, became the sort of mitigating factor in their own relationship. So that was, I mean, that's why the second person, that's why this and that, you know, that was just sort of the best way that I could think of or devise to express those sort of larger ideas. As far as the ending of Jules flashing the night of time, that's, you know, the narrator is speaking directly to his partner, to Andrea, and it's not meant to engage the reader at all. He's asking her an absolutely honest question. You know, they've been playing this very kind of risky game with power relationships and sexual violence and this and that. And the question they've been trying to answer between themselves really is, you know, this idea that you can push as any boundary you want within the limits of consent. But when the thing that's actually desired is the violation of the power of consent itself, how can you, you know, is it still possible to give someone what they want when what they want is to, you know, be dominated in a way that transcends what they want, right? You know, that's a lot of what happens in that story, or that's what he's trying to figure out if that's happened to him.
Yeah.
Right? And he doesn't know. He actually does not know if she tricked him, or if he, you know, flipped out and really crossed a line with her, or if they succeeded in doing something to that third person who's with them. I mean, I don't want to give the whole story away, but...
Sure, sure, sure.
But yeah, no, you know, it's...
But it's also a vicarious inquiry, that question, too. That's why I bring up the reader relationship. At least it could be viewed that way.
I mean, I would be interested to hear you say more about that. It's not something that occurred to me.
Okay. Let's talk about your affinity for Barthelme.
Okay.
There are only two stories in this book that really broach the territory of the phantasmagorical, the jealousy of angels, which mm-hmm. features a sit-down with Satan, mm-hmm. and, of course, Tetris, and maybe a case might be made for the supernatural elements in The New Life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if you have attempted more explicit surreality in other stories that are not included, or other pieces of work that are not included in this collection, and why you tend to dwell on this more naturalistic vein in the stories for the most part.
Yeah, I think over the last few years, this has just sort of been the development of my interest. I wrote, especially at the beginning when I first moved to New York and started graduate school, 2005, really interested in flash fiction and certain strains of experimental fiction, sort of trends in experimental fiction that would probably be best exemplified by magazines like Sleeping Fish, the website Five Trope. You know, all those different things, and And that maybe sort of reached its climax for me when I edited this anthology of short stories about the apocalypse. And not all of them were supernatural or surreal by any means, but certainly when you're talking about the end of the world, you're going to get a lot of that stuff. And that was a lot of the writing that I was interested in. Matthew Derby's first collection, Shelley Jackson, who I studied extensively in undergraduate and have written on from time to time. You know, she was, you know, I've worked with her on a couple different things. And I still really love those things as far as stuff to read, I think I maxed out my own potential as a writer in those veins fairly early on. Not just, you know, I think I did as much as I could do with it. I think I was okay at it, probably not great. Most of those stories are not in this book. Most of they probably won't be collected. They wound up, you know, wherever they wound up, and that, you know, it was really nice. But I think the nexus, in an interesting way, was actually discovering the Gordon Lish School of Writers, people like Diane Williams, Gary Lutz, Barry Hanna, to a certain extent, and finding it, you know, in these writers, this sort of weird overlap between the Carver and post-Carver, you know, realism and dirty realism and whatever you want to call those various veins, and this highly experimental, highly refined prose craft, right? I mean, you know, something like Lutz, I mean, is Lutz an experimental writer? I don't know. You know, I mean, I think that he's one of the most interesting writers that I know. You know, is he experimental in the same way like a William Gass novel is experimental? No, obviously not. I mean, I think a lot of those guys exist at this kind of fork in the road, or maybe like the center of the Venn diagram, or however you want to put it. And so once I wound up there, I think I became very interested in exploring the other side.
But why should such characterization of whether one is experimental or naturalistic matter, even?
It shouldn't. Yeah. It doesn't to me. I mean, yeah. I'm trying to answer the question that you raised it.
Sure, sure.
I don't care at all.
Okay.
To be perfectly frank, it also occurs to me, you know, that I actually didn't say a damn thing about Donald Barthelme in the course of that entire answer. Well, Barthelme is a great case because I don't think he fits easily into either category either. I think that it would be a mistake to identify him as a primarily surreal writer. I think a lot of his best, you know, certainly in the short stories, you know, there are elements of the surreal or the playful, the comic, you know, the physically impossible. I mean, you know, these things happen, but it's certainly not wholly what it's about. And I think a lot of what makes him such a powerful writer, and certainly, you know, one of the largest looming writers in my mind, is this incredible realist and human strain, you know, running through his work. I mean, this profound heart and empathy and a deep sadness and, you know, all the things that you look for in your realist prose are also very much there in stories like, I don't know, you know, The Zombies, Rebecca, Critique de la Vie Quotidienne, you know, The Baby, The School. I could list dozens, just, you know, reason to go on. But, you know, but so for me, that, you know, that's a major part of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to the hair. I had alluded to that earlier. Mm-hmm. It could just be me, but you do have a concern for hair. It's often quite specific. As I suggested, you begin Amber at the window by describing how her pushing a blonde lock behind her ear, stray hairs glancing off a steel row of studs. In My Heart, I Am Already Gone, you describe how Vicky cuts her own bangs, a ragged diagonal like the torn hem of a nightgown. Mm-hmm. In Weekend Away, the hitchhiker has black, messy hair, mostly covering his ears. In What Was Once All Yours, Cass has hairy forearms. I'm curious about this hair, and also, we haven't even alluded to the cat as well. Is it more of a sort of a protective element? You know, these characters are often barren against the elements, so to speak, and I'm curious about this. You are a hair man, I have to say. Or are you the president for the Hair Club for Men? I don't know.
I can't really answer for that. I mean, you know, every writer has, I guess, certain concerns or tics that they might not even be aware of. I asked a similar question to David Berman once. I got to interview him for the Brooklyn Rail.
Yeah.
and I was asking him this question about water.
Yeah.
I said, you know, American water, and there's this line in Actual Air, all water is classic water, and I had, I don't know, two or three other examples, and I finally just asked myself, what's the deal with all the water? And he said, you know, nobody's ever asked me that before. He really didn't have an answer, and then he kind of told this story about mowing his lawn on a hot day, which I think was just supposed to just sort of exemplify that water's nice. And, you know, I don't know, hair is nice, I guess. I don't know why. I mean, it's mostly like haircuts, hairstyles, you know. I don't know why I notice those, or like when I'm visualizing a character that appears or seems to me worth mentioning rather than like eye color or height or anything else. I don't know. When I was a kid, I never liked getting haircuts. I still don't like getting haircuts, actually. I always feel like, I don't know, I always feel like I don't have a good haircut. Like, everybody else has, like, the style that they're supposed to have, and I'm, you know, mine always just feels, like, a little off. I feel like I'm impersonating.
Not one satisfactory haircut in your life?
I've had some decent haircuts, but it was, like, a very early... It was like when I was like a really little kid, it would get long, and then I would like be worried that I looked like a girl, and then they would take me to get my hair cut, and then after it was cut, I would see myself in the mirror and I wouldn't recognize myself, and then I would really lose it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen so much anymore. I've learned to recognize myself.
With more confidence in hair and haircuts.
Yeah, you know, there's only so old you can be crying at a barbershop. Beyond.
I've seen far very older men cry at barbershops.
Well, in any case, the answer is I don't know.
Yeah, that's no problem. The other interesting priority in these stories is when you dwell on Florida, I get a great sense of the weather in these stories, mm-hmm. but not often a sense of the topography. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the mud in the anarchist stories, and there's also a concern for describing the interior, such as the burger shop. But I was really kind of amazed at how you're very drawn to meteorology, weather, hurricanes, and I'm curious about this. It may actually have a lot to do with the early question about names, but maybe mm-hmm. I'm wondering why. What role does topography play in these stories for you?
Topography in what sense?
You mean like location? In terms of being like, sort of like ambiguous or not entirely set up, or more set up around the elements.
Mm. Well, the stories set in South Florida are mostly set indoors because that's how life is lived in South Florida, especially in the suburbs. People don't spend time outside. You know, I mean, I think one set of characters makes it as far as like a backyard pool, and that's about it. I mean, you go from your air-conditioned house to your air-conditioned car, and you drive to the air-conditioned mall or the air-conditioned school or wherever it is you're going, and that's your life. Other stories, you know, like the one set in Gainesville, which is northern central Florida, there's more, I think, the further north you get, as you sort of go north into the proper south, people spend more time outside. They ride your bicycle around, or, you know, you just walk around or sit on the porch or whatever, But the two anarchist stories, which are set, which are really set in Gainesville. I don't think it's named, but that's where they're set. You know, those stories are so much about this house where these people live, that they're stories with, you know, with almost no exteriority. I mean, especially the second one, which is all about, you know, these people that are in the house, and the guy jumps off the roof of the house, and then he comes to live in the living room of the house, and then, you know, he's leaving the house. Why is he leaving the house? Right. You know, I mean, in the first one, at least I think they make it as far as the liquor store, which is sort of necessity, you know, even for those of us who have, you know, who live in these wonderful houses. So they sort of, you know, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No, it does.
So yeah, you know, and that's, but the stories that are set other places, I think I'm more interested in the environment, maybe because I spent less time in those places, so it's more vivid to me. I mean, Weekend Away is, you know, I spent about 4 months living in the Northwest, and that story rolls as much information and visual data and sensory data about that experience as I possibly could. Just to, you know, that drive and what I mean, my feelings about Portland where I lived and the coast where I visited, and, you know, I just tried to get alone there. It was very vivid. To me, maybe more vivid in a certain sense than a place like Miami, North Miami Beach, you know, where I grew up for 18 years, and it's just, you see through it. Tennessee is the same way. You know, I spent a few months in a small town outside of Nashville, and everything, it was just very new. Every experience was very new as it was happening, and so you register all these things.
Do you have to step foot into a place to write a story set there? It seems to me, based off of what you describe, it's your fiction is very much motivated by writing what you know or where you've been in this case.
I would hate to think that I absolutely had to, but it's certainly helpful. And I do like to have a really specific sense of place, which is actually interesting because it's one of the things that's been talked about, I guess, less in these stories. But to me, in my mind, the divisions between them are primarily by geographic location. So the New York story is South Florida, North Florida, Northwest, and then a couple spread throughout the South. And that's really how I think about them in a lot of ways. And even actually some of the places that seem less descript, especially the stories, like the suburban stories that are set in, just this house or that house. In My Heart, I'm Already Gone is one. The New Life is another. They're set in specific houses, places that I grew up, friends' houses that I grew up spending time, that the layout of those houses, the anarchist stories too in Gainesville. Those stories are set in a house that I lived in, and not among the people, I hasten to add. They're not drawn from life stories, not autobiographical stories, but the layouts and locations are all real. And this is maybe the better answer to the earlier question about the surreal and this and that. When I was kind of trying to teach myself how to experiment with realism, how to sort of wean myself off of, the dragons and zombies and, whatever kind of stuff, and trying to figure out how do you write these real stories, one of the things that I stumbled upon or made up or whatever was this idea that because I could never visualize how things were laid out or where they were. And so I started taking neighborhoods, homes, anything that I already knew where the spaces could all be accounted for, and I just understood the topography, I guess, to use your term. And then would just fill them with whatever I want. I could make up characters, but I couldn't always make up where they were. And so almost all the stories, to varying degrees, but some of them, 100%, are real. The real locations populated by invented people, and that was very necessary for me. And once I put these invented people in these real places, it was really wonderful and interesting to watch. Just to see them go to town, how they behave in this living room, or swimming in some old friend of mine's pool or whatever.
So it seems to me that it's easier for you to essentially take from the grab bag of locations you know and use your imagination more for the motivations of these characters. Is that safe to say?
I think these stories reflect that. Yeah, I don't want to commit myself to any party programs here. But yeah, maybe the best or worst, I don't know, depending on your position. The example is like What Was Once All Yours. That story is not set in a place that I'd. I've spent a lot of time in the South in various areas, but that story is not fixed to a particular location, and it is purely the product, I guess, of research, in the sense that I figured out about where they would live and about they describe certain relationships. Corpus Christi is approximately South, and there's like about two Planned Parenthoods within several hundred miles of where they are, which basically puts them in like. Sort of like the there's like this little triangle that's like where the Arkansas, Mississippi, and Texas all share or nearly share a border. And that's about where they live. And they probably live in Mississippi or in Arkansas, almost certainly not on the Texas side. But, that's about where they're at. They talk about going to the Gulf, and Jackson, Mississippi. And so that was deliberate on my part. Because I had a region and not a specific town in mind, I didn't want to specify, and really make a town up from whole cloth. I wasn't going to get involved in that.
I guess this also makes me want to ask you about boundaries, mm-hmm. and whether you are more enabled as a fiction writer with the abandonment of boundaries, or whether you have creative possibilities within limitations. Do you feel postmortem here on these stories?
I don't know what you mean by boundaries.
Oh, like whether you feel that you are more creatively successful when you place your characters within set boundaries, or whether you're more successful just having a wide expanse and eventually getting to the end based off of a more interior motivation of a character.
I would say that's something I probably don't think about. I mean, you sit down, you write, you sit down to write a story, you write it. You don't really think about it, and I don't think about it in those terms anyway. You write what seems interesting to you. A voice starts talking or an image catches your eye. I want to write about this. Well, who's seeing this? What else are they seeing? And you figure out all that stuff later. I don't know. I can't say I've ever really thought about it in that way.
The age declaration at the beginnings of many of your stories, The New Life, I turned 12 on August 9th, 1995. Mm-hmm. Somewhere I have heard this before, Stan was 11 years old. Mm-hmm. What one was all yours? I was a few months shy of 18. Mm-hmm. And then you have, of course, in Somewhere I Have Heard This Before, Mandy says, when you're older, your girlfriends will thank me. Very specific declaration of age. Is this just a very good starting point for you in terms of setting down a declaration in lieu of, say, a name? Or?
Yeah, maybe that's, that's like another way of, but I don't know. I mean, again, I wouldn't think about it it wasn't a conscious decision. I don't think I would have even realized if you hadn't pointed it out, although it's certainly interesting. I think in each of those stories, age plays a particular role, and it actually matters what age the people are. Maybe less so in What Was Once All Yours. I mean, he sort of distinguishes, he's really talking about turning 18, and he's charting that sort of alongside the course of his mother becoming this kind of religious fanatic. That doesn't play a really key, role. It just sort of establishes him at that turning point in his life, I guess. He talks about now being old enough to vote. He doesn't go vote. He doesn't give an indication of how he'd vote. That's not a matter of concern for him. But certainly in the other two stories, age definitely matters. Somewhere I've Heard This Before sort of pivots on this, this 5-year break that happens in the middle, or six, however many years it is. So, you need to know that the kid's 11 at the beginning, because it's going to break in the middle and then he's going to be 17. And similarly in the new life, which was actually a bit of a pain in the ass, to get all the numbers worked out, because, because I'm a short story writer and not a math guy. And like, as I sketched the basic architecture, in the first probably 10 drafts of The New Life, it just didn't matter. I was just writing a story about these characters. But then when you kind of get down to the nuts and bolts and you're fine tuning things and I's have to be dotted and T's crossed and this and that, because you're dealing with people who are in middle and high school, it genuinely matters in a really practical way how old everybody is. Because the difference between being, 12 and 13 or 15 and 16 is the difference between driving or not. It's the difference between you going to the junior high or to high school. And it has to do with where people will be in physical space and what they're physically capable of doing. And for that story in particular, a lot hinges on that in a practical, not symbolic way, right? I mean, so that story starts with, he's talking about his 12th birthday, right? And his best friend who's at the birthday party, and it's this photograph. And so it has to be this very specific moment in time. And then he loses touch with his friend for several years, and then they get back, they become friends again, and the friend's older sister is also kind of in the picture at this point. Now she's hanging out, and it mattered a lot. I literally had to sit down and figure it all out. Brad, the narrator, is a certain age. His friend Kenny is a little bit younger than him, I think. And then Kenny's sister Angela, they're always called Irish twins. There's 11 months between them, so they're less than a year apart, but she's in the next grade up, which makes an immense practical difference, in terms of the lives of people that age, having to do with how much she's around, what she has access to, all this stuff, and who her friends would be, you know, that all gets, that it just all had to be accounted for. Yeah. And in particular in that story, because the, you know, the Grateful Dead wind up playing a sort of minor but pivotal role, it was just, it was too perfect. You know, I mean, the point of that opening line in particular is less that it's the kid's 12th birthday than that it's, you know, the same day that Jerry Garcia died, which is this moment, as he says, you know, it was a moment of great significance, but he didn't know it at the time.
Yeah.
Right? Because why would he?
How did you work out these mechanics? Did you need to do it through the actual text itself, the actual story, or do you rely much on outside diagrams or notes or anything like that? I'm kind of curious.
No, just in the story. I don't know. You know, I mean, if I might have at one point, you know, I might have written all the ages down, like on the, you know, on the back of a napkin or something. But you know, nothing more than that. I mean, you know, that kind of stuff is, I think, you know, less interesting to get into. I mean, it's weird because there is a research component to this stuff. It tends to come later. I mean, like in Weekend Away is another one. You know, I had all these very vivid scenes that I wanted to write. Stuff in Portland, stuff on the West Coast, the hotel. I didn't stay at the hotel, but it's a hotel in Cannon Beach that some friends of mine and I, we went to the beach, and then we ate like lunch in there, you know, in that restaurant before we went back. And so that stuff is all, you know, really easy. But the hard part was figuring out, like, well, okay, if this person is driving from Portland to the coast, you know, to Cannon Beach, and then they're going to pick up a hitchhiker, where is that going to be? And so you pull out, you know, you literally pull out Google Map and, you know, and map the trip out, and figured out it would probably be around Staley's Junction, which is a place I'd never heard of. But then I, you know, and so then I read about that stretch of the Sunset Highway and learned about, you know, what kind of trees you might see and that, you know, that particular patch of the road where, you know, where they were sort of veer off. You know, and then there's that next town down where the hitchhiker at first says that she should drop him off, and then he kind of punts on it. You know, he doesn't really want to go there as badly as he first let on. You know, and that's a place that I'd never been to. I just kind of had to, you know, figure it all out. There's a lot of Google mapping and internet research and this and that. I mean, the same thing with the Planned Parenthood, you know, when I wanted to write What Was Once All Yours. Because I had, you know, I had remembered from a few years back, I had been an intern at The Nation, and I had been a farmed out to do some fact-checking for a big article about, you know, the South and their sort of war against Planned Parenthood. And it's a really serious thing. It's been going on for a long time, and, you know, they've done whatever they can do to run these organizations out of the state in this, you know, in this kind of way where they can't generate the momentum to actually outlaw abortion, so they just sort of try and do whatever else they can. And there really are about, you know, there are parts of the South where there's, you know, maybe, you know, it's like a 2 days drive to the nearest Planned Parenthood. And I didn't want to take it to the point where I was saying, you know, the Planned Parenthood, that's at, you know, blah, 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 and name its address and really position it, because, you know, those people don't need that kind of trouble. You know, they're real people and they're doing a, you know, a very good thing, and they don't need to be fictionalized, you know, and saddled with all my bullshit. But I did the research to get a general sense of, you know, where these people would, whereabout they would be and whereabout they would have to get to, and, you know, and what it might really look like. And, you know, but I mean, the idea is hopefully you don't see any of that, right? I mean, this is not the great, you know, this is not a historical fiction. This is, you know, this is not, I'm not trying to reproduce, you know, the War of 1812 here.
Yeah. Well, so you say saddled with your bullshit. I'm curious, are you reluctant to pluck lines or situations from your life that you've experienced into your stories? What do you mean by this?
No, I mean, I just meant with specific regard to
judgment, or
no, I meant with specific regard to a really existing organization. You know what I mean? You know, if there's a Planned Parenthood somewhere in the state of Mississippi, they're staffed by real people, you know, and they're fighting a very real battle to do very good and important work every day. And so if you put their address down and you set a scene there, you know, you're sort of forcing, I don't know what, you're forcing them into an affiliation that they didn't ask for. That was what I meant. That I didn't want them to be answerable for my perception of them, or for, you know, sort of the broader spectrum of my politics, which may or may not be in line with theirs, or anything like that. I mean, I think we're at a position where, you know, this sort of general idea of, you know, of a Planned Parenthood is like, you know, it's like a copy machine. I mean, we understand we understand what that is. But yeah, I didn't want to take it to that next level. That was all I meant.
Sure. Well, I also wanted to talk about the occasional flashes of 1960s counterculture that appear throughout these stories, okay. And a few of them. The Grateful Dead bootleg that we mentioned in The New Life. The Grateful Dead's return, along with Harry Smith, mm-hmm. in Whistle Through Your Teeth and Spit. Mm-hmm. Maybe this may have something to do with what you were talking about in terms of politics, but it seemed to me that there is some attempt to reconcile that culture with the culture of these particular characters, and I'm wondering, to what sense is there such a struggle in the writing of this fiction and in the working out of these characters?
I mean, the Grateful Dead recur several times just because I'm a deadhead and I like them and I like writing about them and I like, you know, listening to them and all this, and I certainly don't have a claim on whatever aspect of, you know, the counterculture or their heritage, other than you know, being a fan of their music, and whenever Grateful Dead Productions releases something, I tend to go buy it, and they could put out as many bootlegs as they want, and I'll be happy to own them. So, you know, so that's sort of why they pop up a few times. The characters in the stories are not as enamored,
yeah,
with them as I am, and I think that's kind of fair. Also, I mean, you know, you write about what you're interested in, and I suppose if you're writing an essay or you're writing you know, a sort of advocacy journalism or, you know, advocacy criticism, you promote the thing that you're interested in. But in fiction, it's more about just, you know, points of interest and focus. And if you're really going to create characters who are free agents and entitled to their opinions, it only stands to reason that their perspective on some of the things you're interested in would be a little bit different.
Yeah.
You know, and I think both the characters who are really focused on the Grateful Dead in this book are pretty ambivalent. You know, in particular, Brad in The New Life just thinks the whole 90s sort of hippie revival scene is just disgusts him. I mean, he thinks, it doesn't even disgust, it just bores him.
Yeah.
You know, he thinks it's kind of bullshit. And he eventually kind of comes around to the Dead. He gets it that, you know, they're a little different. There's something else happening there. But, you know. Yeah.
But I also sense a certain distrust with pithy little maxims. You know, faith is a perishable good from Whistle Through Your Teeth. The whole line about the type who hits the deadbolt turning but can't tell whether the door's being opened or has just been locked shut from a house in our arms, which I find pretty funny. The book's title, which we haven't even talked about, Everything Here is the Best Thing Ever, which appears in the first and the last story, is a form of graffiti. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if these characters are bound by almost a prescriptive text around them and prescriptive text that they say. And I'm curious if you can elaborate on this interest of yours.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I like all those little expressions, obviously. I mean, I made them up and I deploy them. You know, do I distrust them?
Let's separate the characters. Okay, yeah, but the characters do some distrust these things, or they just greet them often with a certain reticence or just an apathy.
Well, the character named Yana in Whistle Through Your Teeth and Spit, who says the line about faith being a perishable good, she distrusts it to the extent that it sounds like a bumper sticker, right? Yeah. That's her own analysis. But she also made that up. So she says the line, and then she wonders aloud to herself, you know, is this bullshit because it sounds too pithy? And then she says, well, you know, even if it sounds too pithy and really does sound like this long-winded bumper sticker, you know, she asks herself, is it true, right? And so in that sense, you know, even if it's a little more pat than she'd prefer, you know, does that necessarily negate its potential truth value or use value or whatever? And in fact, she seems to feel that there is still a value in that, to the extent that the next thing she does is, you know, she says faith is nothing if it's not action in the world, right? And the next thing she does is she takes action. Her and the guy she's with, they go and they grab that, you know, that big piece of metal that holds, they find it, they scrounge a piece of metal that, like, a stop sign's mounted on. And you don't actually see them do it, but they're walking back to the boutique store on Avenue A where they saw the punk rock album cover silkscreened onto a very expensive shirt, right? And they're going to smash the window of that store in.
Yeah.
You know, they just are. And you could, you know, if you could argue whether or not that qualifies as right action, whether that's an ethical thing to do, whether, you know, the ethics of of smashing somebody's private boutique, you know, are better or worse than the ethics that inspire you to sort of boutiqueify punk rock. I mean, there's, you know, they're not necessarily right to do that, but within the confines of their own ethics and perception of the world, yeah, they have read that message as a profoundly ethical injunction and now are prepared to take action. You know, as far as the title goes, I mean, that's a slightly different case because it's, you know, the title is essentially self-negating. You know, it's, I mean, it's a statement of, obviously the absolutely impossible. So it would be impossible to take the title at face value and do anything with it in the same sense that you could, you know, well, faith is nothing if it's not action in the world, right? I mean, that tells you to do something. You know, everything here is the best thing ever. You know, that doesn't tell you to do anything. I mean, it sort of raises as many questions as it answers, except that the questions themselves, you know, are nonsensical. I mean, what could you really? I'm not sure what can be derived from that.
Well, it depends upon whether you believe in the statement or not.
Sure. Well, that's the question, right? I mean, you know, let's say you want to believe in the statement. You know, what exactly does that have you believing in? Yeah. Right? I mean, you know, the idea of everything and the idea of the single best thing are mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
Right? And so you take this sort of paradox between, you know, the singular of the best and, you know, the all-encompassing of everything, and then you establish it firmly, you know, here, like in this coffee shop or whatever, which itself would seem to negate the concept of everything. And then, you know, extend it through infinity, right? Ever, you know, in both throughout the time-space continuum in both directions. I mean, this is insane, right? Which is why it appears graffitied onto sidewalks and coffee house walls and places where people unload that kind of shit. I mean, if you go into the bathroom here,
we'll probably find something. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, are you kidding? You know, the undergraduates of Columbia have been working out the Israel-Palestine conflict in nothing but fortune cookie aphorisms on the walls of the Hungarian pastry shop for 10 years now. Yeah. And it continues up into this day. I mean, I was in there, you know, right when you got here, and it's...
What's the latest development?
It's madness. Yeah. It turns out both sides have a lot to answer for. One guy thinks you should see the movie The Counterfeiters, which I admit that I have not seen. I don't actually know what it is, but the wall said... I should watch it. Somebody else says, you were supposed to meet me at Grant's tomb on New Year's Day 2010. You know, this is...
Yeah.
It's happening, you know, in bathrooms all over this great nation.
Well, with the conversation firmly cemented in the gutter, I think it would be a good time to close. Justin, thanks very much for taking the time out. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Thank you.